Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Me two.
Wow.
Me three.
Oh.
Roman, fix it.
I think he did.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. Anyway, that was Warren Zevon in The Werewolves of London, which, of course, he made famous in the movie Color of Money with Paul Newman, Tom Cruise, and some Italian broad. I don't remember her name. Hey, welcome to LA. Yeah, welcome to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, on the phone in beautiful downtown Thousand Oaks, California, is my co-host for tonight, Russ Avison.
Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, Russy. And you know what? I have to tell you, I have the greatest dog in the world. Of course, Russ helped me train her.
But well, that explains it all.
She's like the best dog in the world. I just love my dog. So that being said,
I got to ask you a question before we get started with anything.
Talk to me.
Because you're an expert on guns, or at least old guns.
Well, I know a lot of guns about guns, yeah.
Okay. I heard on the radio today that there was there's a term that's called a ghost gun. Have you heard of that before?
No.
Okay. So, unfortunately, I mean, we had another shooting out here in California, and it was in Saugus High School. But the gun that was used was what they called a ghost gun, which is a gun that's made of untraceable parts, and the gun has no serial number.
Oh, well, you know, they have it, the LA Talk Radio, there is a 3D printer there, and you can make a gun out of that, too.
Yeah, well, I just thought it was kind of interesting. I'd never heard the term before.
I had neither.
I thought maybe they had that in the Old West, except did they even serial number guns back in the Old West?
Oh, absolutely. Everything was serial numbered. Absolutely. Oh. Because the manufacturers had to know.
Gotcha.
Okay. So, anyway, our guest tonight is a resident of Calgary, Alberta, and he writes crime thrillers set in Calgary, Alberta. He combines his knowledge and experience as a police officer, look out, Russ, he's a fuzz, and paramedic to write nostalgic crime thrillers. Crisis Point was a finalist for the 2015 Writers of Canada Arthur Ellis Awards. Outlaw is a second in the Brad Coulter series, and Wolfman's Back, which is why I picked the music for tonight's show, the third in the Brad Coulter series, was released November 7th of this year, so it's brand new on the marketplace. He's currently working on a brand new novel in a new series, Speargrass Optional, or Opioid. His experience in emergency services spans 40 years, and a police officer, paramedic, tactical paramedic, firefighter, emergency medical service, EMS, chief educator, and academic chair. He's a very popular speaker at conferences and writing groups presented on realistic police, medical, and paramedic procedures. The co-author of 4 paramedic textbooks. He has spoken internationally at EMS conferences for the past 3 decades. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Dwayne Clayden.
Yay!
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
All righty. You're welcome. We're just love to have you. And I have a note here from our engineer that says, throw to the FBI that we are manufacturing weapons in the studio. So, okay, they just now got
thrown. That was a little disclaimer there, yeah?
So, Dwayne. Russ has read your first book, which was, of course, Crisis Point. I have read your last book, which is Wolfman's Back. And Outlaw, neither one of us read. But tell us a little bit about both those books And your main protagonist is a gentleman named Brad Coulter. And what's kind of like, give us a little plot, subplots of it, if you would mind.
Sure. Yeah. So I started my career as a police officer, and then I realized that people liked paramedics. They didn't really like the police, so I switched over to paramedics. So the basis for the series is if I had stayed as a police officer, what could my career have looked like? And so I guess initially Brad Coulter was a lot of me in the series. And so I was picking things that I thought would be good for my career.
Mm-hmm.
My fantasy, my ultimate career, I guess, in policing. Crisis Point starts out, he's a young cop, he's idealistic. He comes up against the brass that are kind of stuck in their ways. And the bad guys in the story are ex-military who have taken lots of weapons with them when they left, and they are robbing Brinks trucks and banks. And in the story, the way I've set it up, there is no tactical team, SWAT team in Calgary. So they're heavily outgunned. And the secondary story is the creation of the TAC team. And then Outlaw is a couple of years later, and it's a biker gang war. And so we actually had one in Calgary, which surprises people because we're so nice up here in Canada, but there was a biker war. And so I used that as a premise. And so now the biker war is happening, and the tactical team, the SWAT team, now has to intervene. And then in Outlaw, I had this particularly nasty character, a biker who was an enforcer. And the early beta reader said, before they'd even finished reading it, they emailed me and said, "He's horrible. I hope he dies at the end." And so I thought about that. And then when the book was published, I got more emails saying, "You had a chance to kill him. He's abhorrent. Why didn't you kill him?" So then I feel like I did the only thing a writer could do, and I brought him back in book three.
Absolutely. It's like it's better than getting phone calls saying, "Why did you kill off him? He's my favorite character."
Yeah, exactly.
So we have
I want to ask, because you said, you know, people were saying about why didn't you kill this guy off? He's a real a-hole and we didn't want him around. Do you get a lot of feedback about characters and story plot and things like that from the readers?
I am now. There wasn't much initially, but I think I'm getting some momentum, and I'm excited. I actually have some fans now, and and they follow things. The biggest thing is they're saying, "When's the next book coming out?" So the pressure's on to get the next one out. But they do comment on characters, the characters they like, the change in Brad as he's gone along in his career. And I think that's the goal of a writer, is you want your character to be different at the end of each book than they were at the beginning. There needs to be some change.
Sure, they have
and
to grow.
So they're seeing, yeah, exactly. And you have to throw roadblocks in his way, and he has to figure out a way to overcome those roadblocks. That's part of the building of the character.
Right.
People have also emailed me and said, "You had better not kill X character because we like that person." So,
how presumptuous of them to think that they have the right to say that?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, you'd better not kill this guy because we like him.
Right. Do they actually think you're going to listen to that? Nah.
well, that's just it. Yeah. Yeah, they wanted Jeter Wolf killed in Outlaw, and so I mean I brought him back. So I heard what they said, and I just went in a different direction than they expected.
You should do like Jim. Jim just kills everybody.
Well, that's what happened in the Old West. I mean, everybody got killed.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, Jeter Wolf is a downright dirty rat bastard. He really is.
Yeah.
But I have to also say that your Brad Coulter is not exactly Mr. Nice Guy all the time either. He can be a little on the rasty side. So,
yeah, he started out, you know, in Crisis Point as naive, and learned from that. But when the bad guys don't play by the rules, it's hard when you stick by the rules.
Right.
So he spends time right at that line of, do I step over it? And There's times when he's decided now in the later novels that he needs to step across the line. He doesn't have a choice. You can't, when the bad guys don't play by the rules, you can't always follow the rules either.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we had a guest on about two weeks ago, I guess it was. Her book was so lyrical. It was almost like, I likened it to a madrigal, which is a lyric without music. And her book was that lyrical and that well done in that particular genre. It was really a treat to read. But I have to tell you, Wolfman's Back, that's like, it's a treat to read, but it's not a sit and enjoy it. It's sit at the edge of your seat and listen to the hardest rock and roll you could listen to. Think about bandit bikers, because that's what it's about. And it gets downright nasty. And I'm not going to go anywhere near the end of this book, because that's giving away, even halfway through it, is going to give away a big part of the story. So I won't even do that. But I will say it was one of the more enjoyable, nasty reads I've read in a long time.
Oh, great. Thank you. That's
You're welcome.
Right. As one nasty writer to another.
As one nasty writer to another.
Exactly.
I kill off people in really inventive ways, and apparently so do you.
Yeah, so that's the challenge when you realize you're writing the bad guys maybe a little bit better than you're writing the good guys, and you're wondering, what part of my brain is that coming from?
Yeah. Oh, but you know what? You know what I found over the years, and I'm on my 15th novel now, 15th or 16th. But I've noticed that when you're writing the good guys drive your story. They're the ones that the books are about. Yeah. The bad guys are the antagonists that just make everything miserable for the good guys. And they're so much fun to write. They're so much fun to write because you could just really get in down in the ditches with them and get nasty and dirty and grubby, and nobody cares because they're the bad guys.
Exactly. Yep.
You know, and if you don't kill them off at the end of the book, everybody gets pissed off. But they really secretly want to see them come back.
Yeah.
So I you did well, I have to say. And I'm not going to reveal the end of your book, so don't worry. I won't do that.
Great, perfect.
Okay. But tell us a little bit about The Wolfman, because it really is a gripping story.
Yeah, well, so the character is Jeter Wolf, and he was the enforcer for one of the biker clubs in Outlaw MC. And he just really has no filters. I guess, you know, sometimes I think of him as Heath Ledger in Batman.
Oh, the Joker.
The Dark. Yeah. The Joker where the Dark, you know, Knight. He had no conscience at all. And that's kind of, I think, the character that Jeter Wolf became. And he likes violence, he likes hurting people, and he is just nasty. And so bringing him back in, so Jeter Wolf, so his nickname with the bikers was Wolfman, so thus the title Wolfman is Back.
Right.
And so he is out for revenge on everybody who crossed him in Outlaw. And so that includes the prosecutor, the judge, the police officers, anybody who testified against him. He's been shunned by the biker clubs, so he's mad at them. He is just mad at the world and mad at everybody, and he's had some time to plot his revenge and what he's going to do, and he has a plan, and he's working that plan.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and the interaction between he and Brad Coulter is kind of unique. At least I saw it that way. So
yeah, they're definitely
not friends.
Not friends, adversaries, and yeah, there's just that they're probably just both dripping hate for the other person.
Yeah, I would say that would probably be a good way of putting it. I, you know, there, it's a begrudging respect, though. At each one respects the other and knows they're going to come at each other.
Yeah,
eventually.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, right now we're going to take a real quick break, and if you don't mind, LA Talk Radio is where we are on. And if you haven't, If you haven't listened to LA Talk Radio before, you really need to tune in. It's at www.latalkradio.com/content/writersblock. And let's hear a little bit about them.
Hey, it's Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me and you love talk radio, but you just can't find anything worth listening to in that pesky little AM dial, then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is the biggest and the best in LA and is a .com, so we have it all from sports to music to self-help to, well, just about anything including talk. And right now it's coming right at you. Why don't you sit back and enjoy at www.latalkradio.com.
And we are back in the studio with Mr. Brad, or Brad Coulter, Dwayne Clayton.
maybe there's something to that.
I'm sure there is. In fact, he even admits it. But back with Russ and with Dwayne. And if you want to call into the studio and talk to Dwayne tonight, the number here is 818-602-4929. And Ronan will make sure that he gets you right on the air with us. And that number again is 818-602-4929. Dwayne, let's switch gears for just a minute, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
Perfect. What got you decided that you wanted to write a novel?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. In my teens, I read everything that was crime, Ellery Queen, Earl Stanley, Gardner, anything I could get a hold of, and I just loved it. And so in high school, I thought, well, I could try my hand at this, and it really didn't go anywhere. And then, career gets in the way and family, et cetera, and it kind of gets put on the back burner. And then in 2010, I was looking for something to do that wasn't 100% emergency services, because, as you read my bio, I did tons of stuff in emergency services, and I thought I need to do something else. So I thought I had this idea that, well, maybe I should try writing again. I went to work, Googled writing classes, and there was one the next week starting in Calgary. So I signed up for it. And that's where it started. And it's just become my passion now. I absolutely love writing. I love the creating and plotting, and I'm always on the lookout for ideas, on the news or something that has happened in the past that I can use and twist into a story.
Sure. Let me ask you, when you took your creative writing class, and I took one as well, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And the stuff I got from the teacher was just priceless. But the biggest bit of advice I got from my instructor was, tell your story. It can always be fixed. It can always be fixed. It can be edited. It can be proofread. But tell your story. And I always remembered that. And when I wrote my first book, it was a great story, but it wasn't a great book. I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't great. But as you go, you're remembering things in your creative writing classes, and I'm sure you know this, and all of a sudden it's coming to fruition. You're going, that's what she meant. and stuff like that. And now, I mean, writing dialogue to me is like a snap. I love writing dialogue. And telling and knowing how to tell the story, I think, is a real big part of being an author, a writer. So your thoughts.
Let me ask you. Well, I want to ask a question to both of you since you're both writers.
Okay.
So Jim, you say that writing dialogue is a snap and that you love doing it.
I do.
But when you're writing dialogue for a character, I mean, I would think that you have to have a beginning and end thought out as far as what that character is wanting to say.
Right.
So, I mean, do you just talk it out? Do you just say words and say, okay, this is what? How do you feel about doing that?
I do. What I do is once the person starting the conversation or the people talking in the conversation, once they have their say and it's on the paper, I look at it again and say, okay, now how would I, as this person, respond to this? And then once I write all the dialogue, it may be two or three pages, and I'll go back and I'll read it out loud. And what doesn't work gets changed right then. Because your dialogue never works the first time. You always have to go back and work on it. But if you remember that dialogue has to be the way people actually talk. And if it isn't done that way, it's just like reading wooden blocks on a board. And I'm sure you agree with me, Duane. It could be very wooden and broken up. And it's almost like a Swedish person that doesn't know English trying to say good morning, you know?
Yeah. It's tough to write, be in both characters' heads at the same time.
Right.
So I agree. You put the conversation down the way you think it's going to be, and then you have to go back and fix it for the idiosyncrasies of each character's speech pattern or the little tics they have or the nuances that they have. But I'm with you. I love writing dialogue. And one of the things I really try to bring to the novels is what actually happens in a police cruiser. The partners together, the banter that happens back with them, you know, you're with your partner for 10 or 12 hours a shift. You're with your partner more than you're with your family. And you learn a lot about each other, but you also learn where the buttons are. And if you have a chance, you start pushing the buttons on each other until you just rile each other up. So I set something like that up, and then there's a crisis, and you know, all that's forgotten. Now we're a team and we're getting back to business, but you know everything about your partner, really, more than probably anybody else in your life.
Right. Well, if you're writing a story also, Russ, if you're writing and you've got a main protagonist or main hero, main character, you better know everything about him before you start the book. You don't have to put it all in the book, but you do have to know his backstory enough where you can refer to it and give a little bit every time you refer back. So by the end of your first or second novel, pretty much everybody knows everything about your protagonist in little bits and pieces. Yeah, and you better know that too. Because the question always comes up, how do you remember what he did 3 years ago? Well, I don't. I have to go back to the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I hope that answers your question.
You know, it does. I mean, having not gone through the process myself, it's a little more difficult because to understand it. And I would think that, you know, I have this image of a defense attorney in his office late at night preparing for his closing arguments the next day. And he's going to speak directly to the jury. And he's walking around that room. And he's going through the motions of what he's going to say to that jury and where he's going to make the pauses and where he's going to emphasize things and when he's going to raise his arm up to make a point. And I can sort of see a writer doing the same thing, walking around in the room and saying this dialogue and getting it out of his soul so that he can put it down on paper. I mean, that's how I imagine it. It's probably all ass backwards, but.
Well, here's a little sample of some dialogue. I'm working on a book right now. I won't tell you the main story of it, but in actuality, one guy found another guy pretty shot up and sleeping. And he says, Caleb looked over at the man sitting across from the fire. What you doing out here anyhow? I'm a hider. Come looking for the buffler, but all I found was you and a bunch of dead Comanches, said Cotton, picking his nose and fleeing into the fire. Hell, your high ain't worth much, and them Comanches sure made sure I weren't going to get no scalps neither. Bad day all around, I guess. And that's just one guy talking.
Wow.
And it's got to be true to your character.
And you know what's really amazing about that?
What?
When you started saying that, and you put that little accent, the way they spoke, you instantly took me to that scene. I mean, I was there. That was good.
Oh, thank you. But that's actually from a cleanup copy of Jefferson's Chance.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, what old farts don't sit around the fire, especially back in the old West, and pick their nose and flick it in the fire.
Yeah.
So there you have it. But that's just an example of dialogue. And dialogue can make your book or it can make your book a piece of crap. And that's honest to God truth. And I have to say, Duane, your dialogue is phenomenal.
Oh, great. Thank you. Oh,
you're very welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. So, sometimes, I don't know if I hear voices in my head but there's times when I can do both sides of the conversation. I I can visualize it. I can see the two partners in the cruiser, and I can just see the banter happening back and forth.
Well, it's a delight to talk to a writer who actually gets it. And, you know, that's what we tell everybody, never give up your day job. You know, just don't do it, because you're never going to make a zillion dollars in writing a book. This isn't going to happen. But, you know, if you could tell a story and get, I don't know, maybe 100 people to read your story, the next book you get maybe 150. And it grows from there. It gets exponentially larger. And as your fan base grows, now you're challenged with putting out a better book every time you write one.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I'm absolutely feeling that pressure now.
Oh, I'm sure you are. I mean, you're on your fourth book now, right?
That's correct, yeah.
I'm not going to ask you what the Speargrass Opioid's about, because I'm sure I'll see the book come out probably after the first of the year sometime. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Russ, you got anything to ask again?
No. It was something else, because I read the first book.
Right.
And it was very interesting that the way you started the book, I'm not going to give anything away in the story, but the book starts out with this intense scene where this guy is apparently trying to get away, and he's trapped in what I would call is a barn, and he hears the people outside going through the brush and the gravel, and you can hear them walking, and there's dogs coming after him, and it grabs you immediately and puts you in this place. And then there's a sudden little change. You realize that it's not what you thought it was.
Uh-huh.
That was brilliant. I loved it.
Oh, great.
Hey, see? You got two more fans here.
I know. I got a couple more fans. That's great. That's that initial story is actually pretty much a true story of when I was a police officer. I was volunteered to be the bad guy in exercises. And
wow.
So most of that one is right out of my life. That one is.
Yeah, that was good though. But see, the thing is, the way you introduce it, you don't realize that it's a training exercise.
Yeah.
You think it's real. And then all of a sudden you know, the guy comes in Jackson comes in and tells, okay, well, you know, you really screwed that up. You know, we got to do this again.
Well, I'm going to ask another question here about your process. We have determined that we returned the other night that you as well are retired. And so when is your favorite time to write? When is your most comfortable sitting down at the computer and writing on your book?
My most comfortable time would probably be from about now.
I was going to say during an interview on the radio.
Yeah, we're breaking into your writing time. Sure.
Oh no, I'm writing while we're talking, so we're. This would be the ultimate best time, but because my wife likes to spend time with me in the evenings, that doesn't always happen. So I've changed it now to the afternoon. In the morning, I will do editing stuff. My brain's not quite ready to do writing, so I will do editing in the morning. And then probably about 1 in the afternoon is when I start writing, and I will write till 5 or 5:30,
uh-huh.
and then take a break. But there have been times when Valerie has fallen asleep, and I've climbed out of bed and come down to my writing cave and spent 2 or 3 hours writing until the wee hours of the morning.
Gotcha. Now, do you have a regular office writing room that you use, or just like a room that you've designated?
Well, it's a room I've designated, and I set it up with the things that inspire me, and it's my writing cave, and is off limits to everybody else because I've got stuff on the walls and. I put up plot ideas on big, you know, the whatever they are, 3x4 post-it notes on the wall. And, and keep notes and reminders of things. And so it's a room that I'm in, and nobody else really needs to come in here because it's a mess.
Totally understand. Let's take another little break here, And if you're taking a vacation, you have no idea where you're going to do with your dog. Well, boy, do I have an idea for you. And, well, let's just hear the commercial.
You know, if you were in the Ventura area and you're planning a trip and remember there's no way you can take your canine buddy, how about considering All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover? That's right. All Dogs Rule Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. Located on the beautiful Sespe River, if you want a place where you know your buddy will be safe and have lots of attention, being able to play with other dogs, goats, sheep, horses, and even more humans, then All Dogs Rule is the place for you. There's acres of play space, lots of grass, and bountiful orange trees, all with no stress. And a nice list of extras available if you'd want, just ask. So when your dog returns home, you'll have to ask whose vacation was better. Check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call, 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you.
And it just so happens we have on the phone from Thousand Oaks, California, the owner of All Dogs Rule, Mr. Russ Avison.
Yay. I mean, woof, woof, woof. Hey, what was that? What was that music in the back? It's familiar, but I liked it.
Well, you should.
What was it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's we try hard, Russ. We do.
So tell me, what was the music? What was it?
What, the music?
Yeah,
that's called The Gael. It's an old Scottish piece from about the 1710, 1720. And it actually was the opening music to Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, it's very nice.
Yeah, it is. It's a nice piece of music. It's got a nice tempo to it.
Yeah, well, good choice. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome. You know, we here in our production facilities here in Star, Idaho, we just do everything that we can make things happy and make people happy. So there,
because it's too damn cold to go out and do anything else.
Well, that was going to be the next thing I said. Okay, we are back on the air with Mr. Dwayne Clayton and, of course, Mr. Russ Avison. And again, if you want to call and talk to either one of them or myself, and nobody ever wants to talk to me, the number here is 818-602-4929. That brings you right into the studio, and we'll even answer the call and talk to you real live. So there you have it. Okay, next question up on the rack here, Dwayne.
Yep, fire away.
When you are writing, do you set yourself a goal per week, either word count or page count?
I do I'm starting a new novel, I set a word count of a minimum of 2,500 words a day. And I plow through the first version. I don't want to say as fast as I can, but I want to plow through it. I want to get the ideas down on paper right away, and mostly in sequence. And I think the thing is, you just have to write, and you don't worry about editing. You just get it down on paper. The editing can happen afterwards. And I find by doing that, I get in the characters' heads better. Things just tend to flow.
Uh-huh. Now, would you recommend that to a new writer just starting out? Would you recommend that he set a goal, a daily goal or a weekly goal for himself? Or no?
I think they should, because I think the danger is if you don't set the goal, other things will get in the way.
Uh-huh.
And you'll lose the momentum, and you'll lose the push to write. So you just need to write. You know, when you're working and you have family, you have to figure out, you know, when are you going to do that? I know some people who get up at 5 a.m. and write their words and then head off to work. That wouldn't work for me because I'm not a morning person, but I could work into the night on it. So you have to find, you know, what's going to work for you. But I think,
right.
You know, setting goals is great. If you don't set goals, you're just going to wander off in another direction.
Right, right. I actually agree with that. I am a morning person. I get up fairly early every morning, and when I'm not working on this show or another book for our Tuscany Bay Books, which is our publishing company, then I'm sitting down in my own novel and writing. So, you know, it can be hard trying to put everything together at one time.
I have a question about editing.
Go ahead.
When I think about editing a motion picture or a television show,
right,
sometimes they will, you know, they'll take a scene and they'll either cut it or they will maybe put it in a different position within the flow of the show. Do you do that with your writing? Do you take maybe a scene in your book and you say, you know what, I want this scene to be in there, but I don't want it in this place. I want this to happen, you know, later on in the book or earlier in the book. Does that sort of thing happen?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I never gave it any thought. I thought editing was making sure, you know, it was...
Well, no, there's a couple different kinds of editing, Russ, and this is probably a good time to bring that up. There's content editing, which the big publishing houses will do. They have four or five editors working on your story. One of them will be a content editor, or two of them will be content editors, and they will go through for the story, how it glides and how it flows evenly. And if it doesn't, they'll red pencil and blue pencil the shit out of it. And then you get back copies and they're like all red penciled and you go, oh man, it wasn't really that bad. But the truth is, what they're doing is they're putting their take on your story. And a lot of writers just go, okay, fine, that's fine. And then they wonder how come their book didn't do well. Now, and there's also editors that just go through a performance. They go through for punctuation and grammar and making sure that, you know, you have your quote places in the right spot if it's supposed to be a period or a comma. And they go through and they do that and they leave your story alone. That's what we do as an editor. We don't mess with anybody's story. That's not my story. It's theirs. They know where their stuff has to go, not me.
But will you ever make suggestions that you say, you know, if this storyline went in this direction instead, it might be more interesting?
Yes, you can make the suggestion, but you have to leave it up to the author whether they want to accept it or not. And the bottom line is, it's their story. And I don't know if Dwayne agrees with that or not. I will ask him. Dwayne, do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I absolutely change the order of the chapters and rework it. I also, in most of the stories, most of the novels, I've had more chapters or side plots than I needed. So for each of the books, I have a file that I call orphan chapters. And it's chapters that I've pulled out. You know, they're already written, and maybe I can... pull one of those out and put it in another story at another point in time. So Outlaw MC in particular was about 110,000 words when I finished it, which was way, way, way too many words. So I wanted to get it down to 80,000. So that meant a lot of chapters came out. Some got edited and definitely the order was changed. And even up until, well, probably when I'm ready to send it for final edit, I'm still tweaking with the order of the chapters and timelines, because sometimes the timelines just don't quite work out right.
Why do you say that it was too long? And please help me here. I'm really a novice at this. 80,000 words, how many pages of a book would that be?
That'll be about 350 pages in a published book.
350. So your final story was probably... what, more like 550 or 600? I mean, before you started cutting it back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, that was the thing where I was just on a roll in writing, and I was just throwing stuff onto the paper, but, you know, onto the computer screen, and it was just rolling, and I just had lots of thoughts, and I was just in the groove, and then all of a sudden I go, oh, what the heck? Yeah. 110,000 words. How did I get here?
Yeah, I've caught myself doing exactly the same thing. And then I start reading it again because I always try to read a chapter after I finish it. And I get to maybe a page or two and I go, what the hell is this? You know, who wrote this stuff?
Yeah.
So those come out, you know what I mean? Let's take another real quick break here. And if Ronan, you wouldn't mind, how about hearing from Creative Edge, which I'm sure that Dwayne knows very well.
Okay, you've written a book. Now what are you going to do? Well, why don't you give Creative Edge Publicity a try? You see, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. Like an old pair of shoes or an old friend, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and they work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals. So Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future. Mickey Mickelson Publicists, and you could find them at www.creative-edge.services.
And I have to say, actually, Mickey is my publicist as well as he is Dwayne's. And he does a really great job with all his clients. So if you're looking for a publicist, you cannot go wrong. And I'm sure Mr. Clayton would agree.
Oh, absolutely. Mickey does a wonderful job. He's great.
He truly is. And he spends a lot of time with his clients, and that's as it should be. So, Mickey, keep up the good work. Here's a question for you. Yeah, thank you, Mickey. Here's a question for you that I'm not too sure many people ever ask you, or that I ask occasionally. When you're writing your book and you're getting to the end, or you're at the end and you want to format everything and get ready to go, do you look at an empty page and you go, God, I should probably acknowledge somebody?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do. I do acknowledge acknowledgments. And, you know, there's the big fear that you're going to leave somebody out.
Right.
Who's been a big help. But I have a great group of people who helped me out, some early beta readers that just look at kind of proof of concept, you know, does the story make sense? Does it work? Then I work at it some more. And then the next set of beta readers are really looking at it and saying, yep, this flows well. I have one longtime friend who is very critical of my work, and sometimes he makes me cry. But generally I need to look at the things he says, because he reads lots of books, lots of different genre, but this police procedural thriller genre, and he's bang on. So over the time, I've got this group of people who I can really count on and rely on. They each have their kind of specialties, and that makes it important. So I need to acknowledge them absolutely at the end of the book.
Yeah, I was told once that novels don't need to have forewords, and I totally disagree with that, because if somebody has read a beta version of your novel, or at least the finished PDF, and they really like it, why not let them say something about it?
Yeah,
I mean, you allow people to do criticism on Facebook or Amazon or wherever. I mean, I just think it's good for the writer. And it's good for the people picking up the novel to be able to read what someone else has thought about it while you're there.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great point.
So, I mean, now I'm going to shut up. But I don't want to, but I will. No, I don't. Have you ever had or ever thought about having writer's block? And if you had, how did you get out of it?
Oh, my. Yep, that's happened. Well, a number of times, probably definitely in all the novels, I hit a point where I painted myself into a corner, or I just wasn't sure what was going to happen next. The advice I got was that even in the days when you don't feel like writing and you don't know where you're going, sit down and write anyway, because when you come back and review it later on, you probably won't even be able to pick out which day was your bad day.
Right.
So sitting down and just forcing yourself to write, which is much easier said than done, because there's definitely times when I force myself to sit down and I've stared at the computer screen and just nothing is coming. And even the idea of putting anything down on paper, isn't there.
Right.
Generally I will take my dog for a walk. We're across from a really nice park, Bonas Park. We go for a walk in the park. I clear my head and then process things. Wolfman, I had an ending completely done for Wolfman, and then I realized that, the ending just wasn't right. And I had an idea of how to change it, and I just it just wasn't coming to me. And so we had gone to Las Vegas for a weekend of relaxation, and I thought about it all weekend. We get in the plane to fly home, and all of a sudden the ideas started hitting me. I grabbed a pad of paper and a pen, and for the next 3 hours on the plane, by longhand, I wrote out the new ending, and we kind of landed in Calgary. I lifted the pen as we hit the runway and then finished it off. And so that was a different experience. It came when I wasn't expecting it at all. But I mean, I'd been processing it for a number of days or weeks even. And then for whatever reason, it all came together at that moment.
Yeah. I have occasionally what I call writer's pause. And I'll be in the middle of a chapter or something, and I just can't bring it to fruition. But then I'll think, oh, you know what? There's this great scene I thought about a while back. So I open up a new page in Word, boom, type out this entire maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 page scene. And that takes me right back to the storyline again. Now, that's what happened with Jefferson's Chance. That's where the battle scene came in, the final battle scene. And it was all because I had some writer's pause going on, which is not to be confused with dog's pause, Russ.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I do a similar thing. I have a very basic outline of where I think the novel is going to go. And there'll be times when, you know, for example, I'm in Brad Coulter's head. I'll jump ahead, you know, 3 or 4 chapters or ideas to stay in his head because I'm already there. I know what he's going to say. I know he's going to do. And so I'll do, you know, 4, 5, 6 Brad Coulter chapters in a row. And then the next day I'm doing, you know, 3 or 4 or 5, you know, Dieter Wolf chapters, for example, because now I'm in the evil mind head space.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Okay. Are you a pantser or are you a outliner?
I think I'm a combination. So I definitely do an outline, just a basic word or two of what I think that the chapter will be. And then, but I mean, it's a moving object. It's just a place for me to start and finish and fill in the blanks. My characters talk to me. They take it in their own directions. I know that outline is going to change, but it gives me a roadmap to follow, at least, and a good starting point. So it's very basic. I mean, I've seen people who have, you know, each chapter has 5 or 6 paragraphs of what it's going to be about. I figure if you're going to go that far, you might as well just write the chapter.
Sure.
So mine are just basic notes, you know, Brad Coulter's in a car chase. You know, Brad Coulter gets the crap beat out of him, that sort of thing. And then I can go from there because I got the idea. All I need is those few words to give me the idea, and I keep going. And sure. Like I said, I write the novel, I go back and I change the order, and I, you know, delete chapters. And so for me, it's a guideline.
Okay.
How close is your final product to what you originally outlined?
That's a good question.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I would guess, well, I think it's changed as I progressed in writing. I would say Wolfman was probably 60%.
Wow.
Okay. And then going backwards in time, Crisis Point was like 12% maybe of what I initially thought it would be. But that was you know, not necessarily the learning book. But it was the one where I worked on character development. And so what I had initially as an idea changed drastically. I've done an outline for Coulter 4, and I've been plugging away at that. And I'm just, you know, I'm just going straight forward with it. And I think, you know, it'll change. But I think, again, it'll be probably about 60%. Excellent. That's just a guess, but
excellent.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'm going to have to call it because we're out of time. And it has it's been wonderful having you with us. And if you wouldn't mind giving our listeners your email and your website and all that information so they can know where to find you.
Perfect. Well, website is DwayneClayton.com. And you can email me at DwayneClayton@gmail.com. And you can find me on Facebook at Dwayne Clayton Author.
Outstanding. And the books, of course, are Crisis Point, Outlaw, and Wolfman's Back, all available on Amazon.com and all online booksellers. Dwayne, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It was a wonderful, wonderful treat having you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Dwayne.
And next week, we have, of course, it's Thanksgiving. It'll be a best of, and I'm not too sure which one yet. And the following week, December 5th, we have author, writer, and publisher, and just all-around nice guy, Richard Polinelli, will be joining us on the air. And we'll be talking about several different things, including one of the things he's got going with his grandson. So be sure to you listen in next week. Of course, it's Thanksgiving. Everyone have a wonderful, wonderful time. And we'll be talking to you live again on Thursday, December 5th. For Russ, myself, and Bobby Jean Bell, and the whole crew, including the bookie on the Writer's Block, we are out of here.